wind howls over a post-apocalyptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, they'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics, brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Brilliant. Watch that guy and get a million text messages now. Right. Cool. Right, so what I'll do is I'll read out the intro, because it's kind of good for you to hear it. So you can sort of react to it. But if I fluff my lines, we won't go again. I'll just record it after.
No, that's show business. That's right.
That's show business. But yeah, just a bit of coffee. Oh, right. Contemplating an eternity alone this week is writer, director, and producer Rob Valentine, who, as this is a Doctor Who podcast, you probably know best for his many audio dramas for Big Finish. In his own words, his writing combines secret or hidden histories, adventure, and a dash of the fantastic, be that magic, horror, the paranormal, or science fiction. As well as his Big Finish work, he's created audio drama for Audible, BMW Original Podcasts, The Wireless Theatre Company, and Quinn Inc., for whom he directed erotic audio series The Inventor's Apprentice. For BBC Radio, he adapted Howl's Moving Castle, Murmurs, and Cold War thriller series Red Moon, which won Best Online Audio Drama at the 2019 BBC Audio Drama Awards. Rob, hello, and welcome to The Bunker.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me. I do like this bunker, by the way. It's very roomy. It's so roomy, yeah. We're talking via Zoom.
Yeah. Everyone else is dead, man. So you've got you're the only one who made it in.
That's fine. I can live with that.
Two choices, which you grabbed from your bedroom. Luckily, and you only got dog food to eat. But this is not a food podcast. So so that introduction, I think it only really scratched the surface, because your credits are pages and pages and pages of credits, but you never stop working. Just Big Finish itself. I mean, how many Big Finish dramas have you written, and over which ranges?
Well, there's lots of stuff I've written that hasn't come out yet, but I think I'm nearing like my 40th hour of drama written, I think.
And that just for Big Finish. Wow.
Just for Big Finish. Yeah. Since 2019. So I haven't done much else during the pandemic. I was, very kind of seriously locked down, and I'm single, which helps, I guess, and no dependents and no kids, so I've been doing a lot of Doctor Who over the last 3 years now, actually. It's been great. It's probably stopped me going doolally, to be honest.
Because the pandemic, I mean, obviously terrible for the planet and for many people, but in some ways, audio drama, if you're in the audio drama world, it was already sort of ready-made to be online and keep working and keep creating.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the area that had the least to do to catch up.
Yeah, that's right. It was the one recorded medium that was largely unaffected. I mean, there was some doubt to begin with, but it was established pretty quickly that remote recording was viable. I think in Big Finch's case, it was my story, funny enough, Shadow of the Sun was like the first one they completely did remotely. But I think everyone picked up that it could be done. So on podcasts and productions where certain key actors who were vital but didn't have home recording setups, they just like FedExed them the kit and the equipment and the materials to set up at home. So, just very, very fortunate. Being a theatre, it was kind of, I always felt guilty because, you know, my friends who like predominantly in theatre and stuff just got completely mullered by it. But then we could kind of continue.
Yeah, no, I made a short film on Zoom with Louise Jameson and Mina Anwar, and then we did a massive big 4-hour thing, which still hasn't quite come out yet, but we recorded it completely on clean feed. We were in 4 continents all on one recording.
Brilliant.
Which was mental. But the fact that you could do that is, you know, the technology is really there, which, as we were sort of saying off mic, it's a real bonus, isn't it? But it's almost a shame because now no one wants to meet anyone in public because it's cheaper to do it on Zoom and clean feed. And, we don't need to take the actors into the studio. We can do them over the internet now. So
it's a difficult thing because at the moment it's kind of a bit hybrid. You've got actors and engineers and directors in the studio, but then the rest of the other cast members and people who have to be there, they're kind of dialing on clean feed. So it's a mixture at the moment. The downside is, you know, there's no kind of meeting people in the green room and like going down the pub afterwards and all that stuff.
Does Big Finish have to send their famous lunches out to the actors? Because
they certainly don't send them to the writers. That's all.
Because all the actors go, they do amazing lunches at Big Finish, and now it's like,
no. I think at the moment, because I've tuned in, I've listened in on clean feed to a few recordings recently, and I think they just someone orders in Pret at the moment. So you know, but that's, you know, to be honest, that's, if that's slumming it, you're not doing too badly, really.
No. So to sort of begin, you've got lots of time to contemplate as the bombs drop above. your origin story, this show called Doctor Who, when did it first come into your life, and how important has it been to your life and your career?
Okay, well, I think my earliest memories of it are vague memories of just frightening moments of Doctor Who during Peter Davison and Colin Baker's times. I think I have vague memories of like flashes of stuff like Black Orchid, mm-hmm. not really knowing what the hell it was and just thinking, whoop, no, I'm going behind the sofa, thanks.
That was one, Black Orchid. I remember by that, and I've got, I think, 8 or 9 years on you. So
but then with Colin Baker, I remember Trail of the Time Lord. But it was when Sylvester McCoy came along. I was 7 first season 24, mm-hmm. which is just, that is the age at which you know, season 24 is aimed. Mm-hmm. So I was, Sylvester McCoy is absolutely my doctor, and to be honest, still is. He's the one who I kind of really engaged with, and so I was sort of, you know, completely enraptured by Time and the Rani. I thought the cleaners from Paradise Towers were brilliant. And then suddenly, you know, a year later, you had the kind of the quality. Looking back now, it's even more pronounced, but the kind of the quality whiplash with Remembrance of the Daleks, when suddenly this is like, well, this is really, really good. So I just loved it, and then it ended.
Because it's I've been doing this for quite a few months now, and it's interesting seeing how everyone's actual life intersects with the Doctor or the Doctors as they come along. And I was just those few years older than you, so I was a callow youth going, oh God, Doctor Who, so awful. But having done this, when I was interviewing Stephen Wyatt the other day, and I had to go and had to look at Greatest Show in the Galaxy for the first time since Transmission, which I remember I said to him, I remember really not liking this. And then it would just make, and then went, do you know what? I'm just going to watch the whole of Sylvester McCoy. And I've actually been on this journey courtesy of ITVX. And I finally, very late stage, really get what the fuss was about. Like, especially as you say, that uptick, like it's quite hard to watch Time of the Rani still. But that's when they really go, oh my God, they're going. And then they really go out on a high. I mean, one of your choices, I was going to put it second, but actually let's go first. Survival, the last ever Doctor Who program, potentially. As it turned out, it wasn't, but
yeah.
Did you, obviously you didn't know it was going to be the last one ever.
No, I can't, because with my list, I kind of gave reasons why I've picked stuff. And I think for survival, it kind of, because the reasons it kind of it taught me about disappointment and loss. If I was just talking about, like, my favorite Sylvester McCoys, I'd say Remembrance, Curse of Fenric, Ghostlight, Greatest Show in the Galaxy, all that stuff. But I mean, Survival is up there. Survival is a great story by Rona Monroe. It's very, very New Who. It kind of 2005 in its feel.
Oh, it really
But
is. Yeah.
it's also the one where it just stopped. I remember, so I remember in 1990, kind of waiting for it to come back. And this is because, I was a very kind of, unplugged, because there was no internet. And I was very unplugged anyway. I was a long way from a high street, so I didn't have access to Doctor Who magazine or anything like that. So I was just, waiting for the next series to start. It never came. And then I remember watching stuff like Dark Season, which kind of felt like, it's kind of like almost like this is kind of a this feels like a Doctor Who replacement of sorts. It's kind of scratching the itch. But I just remember, for those first couple of years, waiting for Doctor Who to come back, and it never did. It's kind of like, in the same way, this is nothing like a dog being abandoned by its owners and waiting for them to come back, and then realizing, hang on, they're not going to. I'm stuck at the park.
Yeah,
So that's.
listeners. I can say it absolutely is, looking at your face on this screen. Absolutely is like a dog being abandoned by his owners. You look bereft.
I
You're
know, yeah, it was so the kind of I just had that very strong sense as I came in at the end. I kind of, I didn't quite miss the boat, but I just, I hit the prow and fell off, and then it just, so yeah. So that was a very strong sense that stuck with me. And then in 96, or in 95, I think it was, it got announced that Paul McGann was coming back. But those, those were long years. And like I said, I was kind of, I grew up very far from a high street. So although, it's not like I never went into a Woolworths, but stuff like, the Doctor Who books were just not re I saw them on shelves, but didn't know what they were about and never went near them. So I wasn't someone who kind of read Doctor Who novels in the 90s. It was so it was very much kind of absent from my life, barring a few barring Target novels and Peter Haining books, basically. Those were kind of.
Well, yeah, your second choice is Peter Haining, a book I've not heard of before. And you put for that it spurred your interest in history. But I would just say, I mean, what it's Doctor Who 25 Glorious Years, so it's published in 88. When did you first see it? Sort of on publication or?
I think so. I must have, do you know what? I must have given off the, I must have been clear I was into Doctor Who, because I think I got it around that time, maybe on publication, maybe a year later. I don't, I can't, I can't, I honestly, it might even have been a present, like for Christmas or something. I cannot remember. But it was, so 25 Glorious Years by Peter Haining. It's funny enough, I listened to a Toby Haydock podcast recently, where he, in quite reasonable terms, explained why it's the absolute least of the Peter Haining Doctor Who books. But it was the one I had. And it was how I learnt about, other than reading the Target books, is how I learnt that there was a history of Doctor Who. And and all in feet, chapters on each Doctor Who played him. So a lot of what I learnt about Doctor Who, the history of it up to that point, and all the stuff that I had no access to, no way of accessing, was 25 Glorious Years. The scary thing is, we're not that many years off New Who having its own 25 Glorious Years book,
It's
but
really quite scary.
terrifyingly. But
But
it was, this is terrible for the people at home. If there were, if anyone has survived the Holocaust, I actually have it here still. I've still got it. And
I may screen cap you holding
oh
that
yeah, yes, I can.
when I'm going through the audio with the video.
But if inside it kind of as a bookmark, I also have like the 1996 Radio Times 16-page souvenir pullout that came with that. When you have the Return of the Time Lord, where this is Paul McGann as the brand new Doctor, which I at least thought that was going to run and run at the time, I recall. But
Sadly,
yes,
it did
it
not. But good news for Big Finish.
Yeah.
My God, he's
this
he's,
is true. This
I would
is
say
true.
He's probably my favorite Doctor. Oh, he's up there, and that's all down to that. Is not down to the TV movie. That is down to Big Finish.
Yes. And Paul McGann. And Paul McGann. He's
well, obviously, and yes, Paul McGann. Yes. I'm a massive With Nail and I fan. So apart from anything else,
no, same. Oh, yeah. I must admit, that's what I think. Younger Doctor Who fans don't get. Is the power and the adoration of, you know, a lot of us have for Withnot and I. That's actually, yeah, yeah. You know, he's you know, that's kind of a kind of a lodestone that they don't have.
He was famous already, not just for Withnot, but he was kind of, you know, my mum knew who he was because of the Monocle Mutineer. So he was sort of borderline household name. If my mum knew who he was, she doesn't know
who.
then he was quite famous already, but I'll say about the 25 glorious years. Looking it up on TARDIS Wiki, it's got a list of all the things inside. It looks very good, very erudite. But amongst them is one of the bullet points is colour gallery of favourite female companions. It's just a strange thing to pick out, isn't it?
it is a bit.
Not the companions.
The lovely ladies is how it sounds. Yeah, Peter Hayling was not a Doctor Who fan. He was. That's the other thing. 25 glorious years was also I think it might have been my introduction to Peter Hayling as well.
Yeah,
who's one of these, you know, interesting kind of author, journalist, researcher types that you got in a certain period where they're kind of, you know. I think growing up in the 80s, and I think it's probably true growing up in the 70s as well, it was a period of, like, you know, loads of books on Fortiana and strange mysteries, and lots of different books of, you know, slightly inaccurate and dubious quality of research, because, you know, he got a few things wrong, if I recall correctly. But he also wrote books on, as well as Doctor Who, on James Bond and Sherlock Holmes, and he edited loads of short story compilations. But he also did books on Sweeney Todd and Spring Heel Jack, which was kind of useful to me. But he's one of a generation of kind of researcher journalist types who, you know, they write stuff but not cite their sources. So you could never really tell, you know, how much they got from somewhere else and how much they just made up.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a kind of a slightly Wild West period that I kind of have an affection for.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you've got a big, obviously, I don't know you very well, but we have worked together on a Big Finish we can't talk about that hasn't come out.
That's right. Yes, we have.
Which is exciting. But from what I gather from the internet, you have got a sort of Fortean times folklore, folk horror bent.
Yeah, I do. I think really it comes from, I'm interested in folklore and the nature, specifically the nature of belief, I think, is something that is quite important to me. And the power of belief in people's lives, etc. But also, I just think in a more prosaically, in a Scooby-Doo sense, it's great stuff to hang a story on, really. You know, that's kind of my other way in. But yeah, that is definitely a feature of the stuff I'm into.
Yeah.
And again, you know, it's funny how Doctor Who is just another way in to, it can take you anywhere, but, you know, but so if you have an interest in Doctor Who, that interest can then lead into two other realms, I'd say.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's very Fortean events adjacent, most definitely. I mean, whether that's sort of UFOs or sort of ghosts or demons or whatever else is going on. But yeah.
Warp, the near legendary Doctor Who fanzine is back for its fifth issue. As always, it's a sumptuous, glossy, gorgeous feast of goodness, featuring in-depth articles on all manner of Who-related expanded media. Artist John Ridgway and writer Steve Parkhouse discuss their classic Sixth Doctor comic strip, Voyager. And writer Alan Stevens takes us through the history of one of Marvel UK's most popular Whoniverse creations, Absalom Dak, Dalek Killer. There are two all-colour comic strips too, exclusively commissioned for Warp Warp. The Iron Legion returns in a 22-page story written by Lance Parkin and illustrated by Steve Andrew, this time pitting the rampaging Roman robots against the 12th Doctor, while Absalom Dak gets another adventure with the mighty John Ridgeway on our duties.
Hey, Chainsaw Silversides!
On top of all of that, there's the full story of how Canadian animation studio Nelvana came very close to making an animated version of Doctor Who in the 1990s. As well as interviews with the project's key creatives, we've recorded the pilot script as an audio drama. Accompanying the magazine as a cover-mounted CD, it stars British sitcom legend Arthur Bostrom as the Doctor.
Endless vast wastelands. Distant nothingness stretching as far as the eye can see. Not very inviting. Could be Milton Keynes. No, the stars are all wrong. Very wrong indeed.
Continuing our dedication to the printed form, Warp Warp 5 is only available as a physical copy and can be ordered from anywhere in the world for the UK price of £10.99 plus shipping. For more information and to place an order, visit warpwarp.co.uk. The link in this episode's notes will take you straight to the shop.
Your next choice is the Demons itself, John Pertwee, which is in a lot of people's top stories. It's an amazing. I mean, it's up there for me. I must say, I love Nigel Neal. And even though he did not approve of Doctor Who, especially for things like the Demons, which ripped him off so shamelessly, but I do absolutely love the Demons.
Oh, yeah, I picked it because I thought I should probably pick, you know, something I could, you know, if I'm down in the bunker, what can I probably watch more than others? Mm-hmm. It's not the best John Pertwee necessarily, but it is I think it's as cozy as Doctor Who gets. It is, you know, it's tea and a cup of tea and a plate of biscuits, you know, in Doctor Who form. And it just ticks an awful lot of boxes for me. Again, it's got that kind of, you know, folk horror kind of Dennis Wheatley satanic panic stuff to it. It's extremely Quatermass for children.
Yeah.
It's got all the camp fun of you know, the BBC Three shoot. It's got it's got slight kind of an Earth mystery vibe to it. So it's feeding into all the same kind of stuff as, you know, Children of the Stones and all those kind, you know, and a lot of that kind of, you know, that 60s stuff that kind of lasted into the 70s, you know, Arthur Clarke's Mysterious World and things like that. It's just, you know, I think by the time I was on the scene as a little human being, that was already kind of in the past. But I think it's by the time I was kind of becoming aware of things, it had seeped so deeply into popular culture that it was just there to be picked up. But I think just the Demons is just a perfect example of
How early in life did you see the Demons, or did you read it first like I did?
I think I read the Target novel first. Mm-hmm. And then I don't believe I would have caught it on VHS. I think I might have seen it first on whenever BBC re-screened it in the 90s. I'm not the kind of fan who knows when that would have been, other than I recall watching it on BBC Two at some point.
It was, what year was it? Was it 93 when they did all that? I think I had them all recorded on VHS.
Yeah, and I
got that VHS.
Yeah, I'd have been 13, which would have been the perfect age for it. Yeah.
Other rabid fans listening will be going, no, it was that different series of repeats. But anyway, because they repeated the Sea Devils at some point as well, so that's why the Sea Devils is seen a lot by people.
They did. I think I want to say 96. Please, I'm people listening at home, I don't mean to set your teeth on edge. I'm sure you. I don't know when it was, but I'm guessing 96. Yeah. Subjectively that feels right, just from my own addled memory.
Young people are just going, oh gosh, people deciding when they watched repeats. How quaint! I'll just go to
I know.
Just go to Britain and watch everything.
Yeah, I used to watch so many films, and I just can't these days because they're all there at my fingertips. I function. I sound so old. I functioned way better when they were just rationed to me by terrestrial television on broadcast. You know, if you want to stay up to 11 a.m. to watch Alligator, you've got to stay up to 11 a.m. to watch Alligator.
What a movie Alligator is. I
Wolfen and
forgot
stuff like
about that.
that. Yeah, those were the days.
We had the VHS of Alligator. Well, my friend did, and we borrowed it for what seemed like a long time and watched it about 20 times.
Oh, it's so
Alligator.
good. Yeah. For anyone, for any young people, it's and alligators get flushed down into the sewers in New York, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they don't stop, basically. It's very, very good.
Jaws in the City
Yes.
is basically it, isn't it? But a double bill with Orca the Killer Whale, I seem to remember. We always had
Yes,
in a similar period. But yeah. So the demons, have you been to the village?
Do you know what? I haven't. I, funnily enough, in 20 early 2020, I was thinking that this is the year. Okay, in autumn, I've saved up some money. I'm gonna go and visit Petra. But in the meantime, I'm gonna visit Aldeburgh. I'm gonna go up and go to Whitby, see the Abbey, and go and see the Hand of Glory in the local museum. I'm gonna travel over the country and see all the places I want to see. And then the pandemic hit. So no, I haven't, but I keep meaning to.
Yeah, it sounds like a people I know who've gone, it sounds like they always have a really good little mini convention there, and it does sound like a good one.
I think where it is, you could do a really good day out getting it, and you could get an Avebury and Stonehenge all on the same day as
Yeah.
well, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that part of the world quite well. I spent well, my friend used to live in Uffington, and I used to stay with him a lot, and then I had a few months living with him in within sight of the White Horse,
Oh, wicked, wicked.
and we watched the yeah we watched Children of the Stones a lot, and his house was haunted. It really, I don't really believe in ghosts, but there was some, if that was the closest I ever came to believing in them.
That's
There
fantastic.
was something in that house, and it was built over a graveyard from like, well, abandoned graves from the 13th century, and then a big church, and it was the nearest to being in a ghost story I've ever been. It was terrifying.
It's a spooky part of the country. It's I think Wiltshire and its environs
Yeah.
is it's it's very big on UFOs. It's
Yeah.
very, very big on ley lines and fairy circles and crop circles and all that stuff. It's yeah, I
Yeah.
might retire there, I think.
Oh,
Yeah.
you'll need some cash. It's in yeah, Nuffington.
Ah, right. I might not retire there.
It's got the keyboardist from Marillion lives there and things like that. So the local pub was always a good mixture of farm hands and men of the horny handed men of the soil, and then really, really rich people who like had their studio in their house and a mansion around the back and things like that. But yeah, brilliant, brilliant place to live. Brilliant place to live. And everyone Morris dancing at a drop of a hat. Seemed to be the thing. But yeah, so with the demons, that the demons, your choice particularly made me think of your brilliant third Doctor story you did. Tell me the
Oh,
next.
the thank you very much. The Devil's
That's
Hoofprints.
the one, yeah, the Devil's Hoofprints. I was busy trying to find it on a screen and couldn't. But yeah, the Devil's Hoofprints, that was actually really, and would it be safe to say you had the demons in your head for the DNA of that story?
In a way, yes, because when you're writing for Big Finish, there are lots of kind of different ways to write for Big Finish, and because there's more than one way to take Big Finish, and one of the ways, and it's kind of set specific, the way I see it, people who for the Third Doctor Adventures, this was a Third Doctor story with Tim Treloar as the Doctor. The way that the intention behind that series is that you kind of it's kind of chasing the dragon, really. But they hate me using that phrase, but it is. It's kind of it's getting that hit of the Pertwee era as authentic, as kind of authentically and kind of evocatively as possible. So some series you want to write stuff that kind of is totally original, feels very fresh. And this was not aping the demons in the slightest, but just, I think, to be honest, just the title itself, The Devil's Hoofprints, kind of is evocative of both the demons, but also the sea devils. The story itself was it's a bit of folk horror based in the Southwest, based on the real case of the Great Devon Mystery, the Devil's Footprints Mystery. But part of the intention is to just give the fans of the era kind of just a psychic whiff of what they miss, really. And that's kind of, that's not the same of all Big Finish, but it is, I think, more true of things like the Third Doctor era than it would be of a series that still had a living Doctor played by the actor who is that Doctor. So I think it's just part and parcel of it's an evocation, to use a kind of a supernatural term. So I think that's kind of why the titles and stuff like that, they kind of it doesn't hurt to evoke more emphatically and more conspicuously, I think, than it would in other ranges.
Yeah. I mean, Big Finish is it's a fascinating thing, the sort of history of Big Finish. I'm sure someone will write a massive book about it one day, because it is a fascinating little, from its humble beginnings to, it does so many, it's got so many different USPs. It's not just got one, because like you say, part of it is sort of evoking sort of past eras of Doctor Who, and it all depends, that trading on that nostalgia, which I think all humans are nostalgia prone, but I think with Doctor Who fans, it's our nostalgia is definitely linked to this show, isn't it? And so which one you watched when you were a kid is the one that you want more of mostly. So for me, it's not that the actor has gone, because it's Tom Baker, but that, I just absolutely love that, it's Nick Briggs sort of saying Tea Time 1977 is back. And they were just absolutely, when I heard those, they gave me a proper shiver of, this sounds like Jameson had stayed on for an extra, had done an extra season kind of thing. Absolutely brilliant run. But there's so many different things like that. But then you've got Big Finish doing, all the different gaps that they fill in, or, latch onto to make so many different stories, because Doctor Who is so many different things, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
And especially now, it's not just, it's not just, oh, here's a show that's never coming back. It was, it was continuing McGann, and then also looking back, and then it was doing McGann when the show was back. That here's McGann if he had a show now, which was also brilliant. And I mean, just so many different things. I mean, so I was going to ask you about sort of more in detail about, you touched on before. So did you only write for Big Finish in 2019? Was that your sort of
first? Yeah, that's right. I won the BBC Audio Drama Award for Red Moon, and then the next day I got an email from Matt Fitton inviting me to write. This was like after I'd known Matt for a couple of years, and I kind of assumed it was kind of, Matt suddenly had the justification to suggest me as someone. But I think it was actually I learned that it was Louise Jameson who recommended me, because Big Finish came second. That was 4 years ago, about around now. So the next day Matt emailed me. So it's been about 3.5 years, maybe 4 years, 3.5, something like that.
And you've got 40 hours, and that's like 10 hours a year of Big Finish.
Yeah. It's been great. They like my stuff, which is lovely. And I'm getting to script edit for them, so I'm getting to work with writers, as you know, because I'm scripting you. But now I'm producing and directing for them as well. So it's been really great, and just very, very kind of fast. But I've had other than my other kind of commitments to other, sort of clients and stuff, I've had nothing else to do and no one to do it with. So So yeah, they have. You know, it's kind of, you know, life has not, has felt a bit like Silent Running, but instead of, you know, robots to play with, I've got Big Finish. It's kind of, yeah. Does that sound tragic? That sounds tragic, but yeah, it's okay. It's
you're also getting
good.
It's,
I get paid for it too.
Not just some weird hobby.
No.
It's a job, but yeah. But I mean, I think their instincts were right, obviously, because you're obviously you're I do like your stuff. I particularly liked your Lovecraft invasion as well.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, that was fun.
Massive Lovecraft, and I say I'm a massive Lovecraft fan, but really, I'm a person who played the role playing game when I was younger.
Yes, yeah.
Maybe I've read some Lovecraft as a result of playing Call of Cthulhu endlessly, like the brother of the character in the piece. But yeah. But so is Lovecraft part of your DNA as well? Or
I got into funny enough, because everything is connected, and it's always fun kind of following the threads. And I kind of think my first introduction to Lovecraft, really, or anything that was Lovecraftian, was actually Ghostbusters, which is a hugely Lovecraftian film. Yeah. It's incredibly Lovecraftian. Ivo Shandor is and his kind of, you know, his interbellum Gozer cult is extremely Howard, and even, you know, Gozer itself is, you know, it's a great old one. And Ghostbusters 2, Prince Vigo is extreme with his portrait, is Charles Dexter Ward. So Dan Aykroyd clearly knew his stuff. It's one of those things where you kind of, in many ways, you discover through what, you know, what you could either call lowbrow popular fiction, you kind of, that leads you on to other stuff. Not that H.P. Lovecraft is highbrow, but that in turn leads you on to other stuff. And you end up, you know, I mean, it's all a load of tosh, but stuff like you read the Witch Cult in Western Europe, and, you know, the Golden Bough the Hero of the Thousand Faces. You know, if you're a Star Wars fan, that kind of leads you on to all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
Campbell and
then Vogler.
then Christopher Vogler, yeah, exactly, yeah, which is actually a much better read, yeah, but
that's the one that ruined Hollywood.
Yeah, so it's yes, exactly.
that's too. Formula
that George, here's a formula, now go away and don't, yeah, exactly.
I teach screenwriting every so often, and then came Save the Cat. I don't know if you've ever read Save the Cat.
I have. I've never read Save the Cat because I think I disagree with the premise of the title.
Yeah.
Other than with Big Finish, because Big Finish these days are very strict with what you can and can't do, because suddenly Doctor Who is this massive, massive property. I think I don't think by nature I'm the kind of writer who is too concerned about the dog surviving.
No. But yeah. I mean, I think Save the Cat is more, he calls it that because he thinks he's really clever to have noticed that to make someone likable, you have a Save the Cat moment. And yes, it is quite useful to know. But it's also such a reductive way of looking at structure. And then it becomes a cult in that all his beats are, his 15 beats are actually quite useful. But it's when they then take it too far and go, it has to happen on this page. And then you get execs.
I detest that, yeah.
Then you get execs saying, you haven't stated your theme on page 5. And why is this, you know, and they don't know anything. But they're in charge of some budgets, and they're going, well, your screenplay is too many pages, and you state your theme in the wrong place, and your B plot comes in too early or too late, and all this bollocks. And then when you get to Save the Cat website, because when I've got students, I tell them your Save the Cat is useful, but it's also utter bollocks, and you must beware, because it's, and when you get to the Save the Cat website, they have these beat sheets, and they crowbar movies that don't fit them to try and go, look, Blake Snyder.
Yeah, it's Sager, yeah,
right. And it's like, no, it's Jurassic Park. It doesn't fit at all.
It's getting it the wrong way around. All these yeah, different story theories, they're all flawed attempts to describe something innate.
Mm.
Right, you know, so that's kind of, you know, if as long as you, I think, absorb them all, you know, but they're all just individual tools on a Susami knife.
Yeah.
Attempting to identify something that we all do just naturally because we are storytelling creatures. We've evolved for it. There are very specific, you know, like evolution. There are good evolutionary reasons that we respond to narrative the way we do.
Yeah.
And all these things, they're just attempts to identify that structure, but I think they're probably best looked at all together rather than picking one as the paradigm. They're all, you know,
yeah,
it's probably better if you pile them all on top of each other, use what's useful, discount the rest, and then just see how you've created works on you and on others, and do it that way.
Yeah, that's why John York's book Into the Wood is very good, because he kind of has his cake and eat it. He says, you know, Russell T. Davies doesn't believe in this. Lots of people don't believe in this. But the fact is they write like this. And so does a 7-year-old child, because we innately know story. And then he has this brilliant bit in the appendix, which I will show my students, which is about 50 of the well-known gurus. And it has a chart and it just shows all the different ways of doing story and just shows you kind of what bollocks they are that they say they're the right way, but also how much they've got in common. And that's because that's what we do when we say once upon a time, there was a man and he did this. So it's just,
exactly. Yeah.
I'm fascinated by story and everything, but as it particularly, applies to Doctor Who, your little note when you picked Sharda, the epic Sharda, and you said, what did you say? You said, Sharda and the impossible idea of the perfect Doctor Who story. So I wonder if we touch upon Sharda and of the perfect Doctor Who story.
I picked Sharda because I've got full disclosure. Sharda is a story that it's better in my memory than it is me having to actually watch it in any form. Because don't get me wrong, there's a lot to love about it. But I think by around episode 5, I'm kind of thinking, oh yeah, this is kind of, you know, this is padding now, or it's not that great, or whatever. I think a part of it is the Cambridge stuff is what's one of the things which is so wonderful about it, and it just goes on too long and whatever. But in my head, Sharda is always brilliant. It's much better than the reality of watching it. And so just kind of, and also because it was never finished. So there isn't, it's not like it was, you know, finished and junked or thrown in a skip and lost. It was never finished. So it is the Doctor Who story that never properly existed. And yet we've got so many different versions of it, which are all in their own way great. I mean, I love the Big Finish version with Paul McGann. It's a really great way of updating it.
Is that the one that they put onto the internet as well?
Yeah, it was. It was
the webcast
version.
Yeah, that was my first experience of seeing Sharda, Paul McGann and Romana. And I remember liking it, but it was weird looking back because that, you know, the animation then, the sort of Scream of the Shalka era, Flash, whatever it was very primitive compared to what we've got now.
Yeah, the BBC cult website, the skeletal remains of it, that it's still kind of archived on the BBC site. You can still kind of go and visit it for what's left. I'm terribly nostalgic for that, but it was that, because I think I discovered it like in 2004 or something. But
yeah,
that's an aside. But yeah, but Sharda, yeah. So Sharda is just like kind of like this platonic idea of a Doctor Who story, because there is no, it only exists in your mind fully. And, you know, you can watch all the different versions and then kind of, you know, create a perfect version of it, in inverted commas, in your memory. But it's just, the reason I phrased it that way is that I've reached a point where I've written a lot of Doctor Who, and it's just that knowledge that as soon as you sit down, you're asked to come up with an idea or pitch a few ideas, or you're given a brief or a list of actors who are available and therefore characters you must include in your story. Whenever you begin anything new, all those infinite possibilities of all the stories you could tell, ultimately, as soon as you start typing, you are limited to the specific and just this is the thing you are working on now. And it's just as a writer, that's all, just always a really interesting stage for me, where it's like, you know, you have all this huge realm of possibility. Then no one, it, ultimately, it's going to be, this is what you picked. Those were the choices you made for good or ill. This is the story you've written.
Like and, you're flipping and, yeah. and turning opportunities off. And but the really hard bit is when you're God at the beginning and like you're the only one that can make decisions. And that's kind of the, oh my God, what, it could be anything, but it's got to be something. How do I make this story? And it's a never, I mean, if you're into it, which obviously we are because we're writers, it never quite satisfies you, but it never gets boring either, does it?
I think that's the thing. It's, I think every decision you make, you've cut off all the other possibilities.
Yeah.
And when you're finished, that's what you created. And, you know, sometimes it can just, you know, however happy you might be with it, it can just kind of, once it's done and over, just kind of turn to ashes in your mouth. And ultimately, really, I think all we're ever left with properly is the process. And that's the back and the experience of actually doing it. Mm. And that might be the best bit of anything, because once it's done, it's dead. You know, it's for the audience then, or the viewer, or the listener, or whoever. You know,
with Doctor Who and any story, I always think you have to sort of be part perfectionist in that you have to keep going, but you also have to let yourself off because you're on deadline, and the audience won't actually ever know what you've deleted. Even though you're always going to miss that line you had to get rid of. Awesome.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you reach the point where you have to go, no, good enough.
Yeah.
Good enough. Move on. Maybe the next one will turn out better or whatever, you know.
Yeah, it's like that Coen Brothers quote when people ask them, how do you write your screenplays? And they go, we write them and we redraft them, and then suddenly we're making the movie. And then we can't rewrite it anymore. So it's just like, there's a deadline at some point.
Exactly. It's the only way to stop. Yes.
Yeah. It's you can't go back to do that one because you've recorded it. And I mean, it sounds like you've been in the crucible. I mean, obviously you've done lots of writing, but the crucible of your 3 years in Big Finish land, like, how is it changing you as a writer, do you think? Or
I know that's a really good question, and I think
being so often writing Doctor Who, or the
it,
Who,
it has changed me as a writer in a way. For one thing, I think one of the main things is that I've discovered how much, and because Big Finish isn't the only stuff I've done. I've written like a couple of series for BMW, and as you said, adapted House Moving Castle, and I've had other projects on top of it. I've realized how fast I can write for other people, but you know, so yeah, but with my spec work, suddenly it's a whole different story. Yeah, so I've kind of, you know, the only difference now is I'm kind of, you know, this has become my new day job. I'm too busy to write because of But it's just the kind of that realization. Oh, when you're writing for other people, you can write fast well, or we can write well fast. It's just, you know, it's just a certain kind of discipline. I've just, you know, and also it's just kind of a habit and a process. But I think the other thing is actually just having written this much. It's a silly amount in many ways, but you kind of. I try to kind of take you know, Alan Moore's advice. As soon as you're aware of a technique that you're using, as soon as you're aware you've been using it, drop it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, it's something I've tried to do. But it's a difficult one, because sometimes I might go back and read something I wrote a year ago and realize, oh, I used the same, you know, I've used the same figure of speech. Must never use that again. I've used this, and it's a figure of speech and thing I'm writing now, or whatever. Yeah, and then of course these two fucking things, they get released they're written like 18 months apart, and they're like released. They're released like a month between each. It's like, oh, for fuck's sake. Yeah. Makes me look terrible. Look, listable. You know, if someone's listening to stuff consequentially.
You mentioned Alan Moore, but that reminded me of somebody very adjacent to Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman. He was on the, I was listening to him being interviewed by Samir Ahmed, I think. And he's had all his collected works, which I would recommend anyone get, but he just said rereading them was like, you know, like, oh, I'm quite proud of myself. But then he said, are you, how many times can I describe someone as having fucking silver hair? And it's just like, silver blonde hair. And it's like, why? And he was completely unaware he'd done it in just so many short stories.
Exactly. Yeah. It's exactly.
Yeah. Oh, that's quite a sort of wan, slightly elfish thing to describe someone as being, having silvery blonde hair. Again and again and again, because he's writing.
See, I suppose works aren't really meant to be collected. But the good. I suppose a good thing is he'll never do it again. That's the only upside.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So the idea of the perfect. Why Sharda in particular as the that makes you think of the impossibility of the perfect doctor?
Probably because Sharda is incomplete.
Oh, I see.
So it's, you know, it's like, you know, the whole
script, thing. It wasn't as a script, though, was it? So
no, but the script isn't the that's the thing, the curse of the dramatist. Script is not a finished product. It's a blueprint for the finished product.
I
think I picked Sharda because it's very, very good, starring arguably the greatest doctor, but it's got that Persian flaw of not being complete. It's not finished. Yeah. So I think that's why Sharda just stands out as a good jumping off point to talk about just the idea of a Doctor Who story.
It's also very long, and you in my Love and Laverne hat, I'll allow you to have every version of Sharda in the bunker. And you can compare them
first.
But yeah, because in preparation for this, I've not watched Sharda for many, many years, probably since 20 years or something. And I remember watching the version that's got Tom walking around the exhibition doing
between,
which is bonkers. But I went on ITVX and I thought, well, I wonder what version they've got. And it's the animate. It's got all the animated stuff in between. It actually works. And for the first time, I really got it as a story, I think.
Yeah, I love that. I love
all the bits I've seen. But this was the first time I went, this is actually really getting me. Oh my God, it's Douglas Adams. I almost think it'd be up there with City of Death if it had been finished, I think.
I think so. I mean, in a weird way, I can't think
perfect. Maybe a City of Death, but it's still.
Yeah, really, it's like the one good metaphor for it is just comparing Christopher Neame to Julian Glover, and that's kind of the difference.
Yeah.
You know, but I also love how just you know, so much of Sharda and bits of City of Death pop up in Dirk Gently, and you know, he was not one for not recycling material. So again, it's just another reason why Sharda's great is that it kind of. It ended up dispersing into other works as well.
I love my Douglas Adams because Hitchhikers is one of my sort of formative
same
and but I've always been a bit down on him as his involvement in Doctor Who. I think tonally he quite often got a bit too jokey, but City of Death and Sharda are reminders that when he gets the tone right, it's really witty, but it's also exciting adventure, and it doesn't end up with the stakes not being high because everything's so throwaway. It is really just a shame that, you know, Sharda didn't get finished, especially because they ended that season on bloody Horns of Nymon. And
but I kind of think the fact that it didn't get finished means that we are endlessly talking about it in kind of an infinite loop, you know.
But it is it's got some wonderful things in it, and I was actually really impressed by the animation.
It's beautiful, and also the score really evokes the period as well.
It's a brilliant 2 hours long though. It's like a proper. Yeah. I was turning it on. I was like, "Oh, I'm right in the mood for 2 hours of not doing anything." sometimes I've got to watch this thing, and it's like, "Well, I'll make notes during it." But I was just like, oh, "I'm going to sit down, I'm going to watch Sharda properly," and it was I loved it. So thank you for putting it on your list because it's
wonderful.
So from Greatest Show in the Galaxy from Stephen Wyatt, ending up with me completely finally getting Sylvester McCoy as a doctor.
I'm glad.
I always liked him, but because he's not my era, it's kind of hard.
Yes.
If you're not spurred on by nostalgia, It takes a special.
I must thing admit, yeah. I mean, I have trouble. Yeah, I have trouble wrapping my head even now around the fifth Doctor's era again, because it's kind of, you know, I find Bidmead just a little bit distancing. It's like, that's not Bidmeadian sci-fi is not my idea of a good time. I mean, I like lots of the stories, but it's just it doesn't, what they could say, it doesn't vibe with me, basically.
No. Well, that's the thing. Doctor Who changes so often, and that's why it is forever.
Exactly.
And it's also forever creating people screaming at each other on the internet, because how could you possibly like that era when this is there? But you know, it's a good reminder that we don't all like the same thing. I don't know how, when you see youngsters and they're, because they're usually youngsters, just going, how did anybody watch the Hinchcliffe era? Why does everyone keep going on about the Hinchcliffe era? And I'm like, are you mad? It's perfection.
Yeah. I kind of think with, especially it's young fans, I think for the most part, and a few deranged older fans as well. Yeah. But I think a lot of it's to do with, you know, patronizing middle-aged person, but you're kind like Gary, you're finding your identity.
Gary Russell really doesn't like the Tom Baker era.
Yeah.
He's not shy about it. He's like, I stopped watching when it was that. It stopped being Doctor Who until Peter Davison came back. So everyone's got a different way of getting into it. But yeah. But Tom Baker's just, for me, it's Tom Baker. And he was probably Doctor too long, because there's a whole generation, my generation, we still haven't quite got over him leaving. Like it was a real sense of loss. Like,
yeah, don't know what people might think. I kind of think it might have been good if he'd regenerated at the end of Sharda.
Yeah.
And then have a brand new Doctor for a brand new era. But then you'd miss out on stuff like State of Decay and Warrior's Gate, which I love both of those. So we have what we have, and then we just have to kind of negotiate our positions in relation to them, you know.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you. On you.
Coming soon from Cutaway Comics, phase one of an epic new saga, Gods and Monsters. Issue one, Faustine, Princess of Tharin, written by Stephen Gallagher with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue two, Sutekh the Heretic, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And issue 3, Omega El Tralla, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space, coming soon. Follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe, or visit cutawaycomics.co.uk.
Before we get into your last choice, is there any? Well, obviously you've got stuff coming up which you can't talk about. But is there any sort of era that you're looking forward to one day writing for Big Finish?
Well, I say this to everybody, and it still has. I've written a lot of Doctor Who, but no one is letting me, it seems, write for the Seventh Doctor. So I would love to kind of get to write something that feels like season 27. Obviously, the season I was waiting for that never turned up. So I think actually kind of, if I could get to write something for the Seventh Doctor and Ace that felt like you know, something, the kind of thing I was kind of hoping would rock along in 1990, I think maybe then I could finally have some kind of closure on getting left at the park by the family.
Finally get that closure. So have you met Sylvester McCoy?
No, I haven't. I've met Tom Baker, and I've met Colin Baker. So I've met the two Bakers.
Yeah.
And I shared a Southwest train into Waterloo with Peter Davison once, but he doesn't know that.
That was. Did he realize you'd clocked him? It's always reminds.
Oh, no. I'm good. I'm good at lead. You know, if you see a stag in the forest, you just let that stag be. You know.
Yeah. It reminds me of that story Russell T. Davis tells when he was a young Granada employee, and Peter Davison was at some event, and he went. He sort of was near him, and Peter Davison just turned around and went, "Oh God, you're one of those, aren't you?" He could just totally tell he was eyes on Storch. It's a doctor. Kind of thing. But I've worked with Peter Davison, but over Clean Feed. So I've never met him, but he seems wonderful. And Colin I met a few times. But yeah, Peter I met at LA. Sylvester I met at LA.
Oh, brilliant.
Galley last year with him and Fraser Hines. So we ended
up. Oh, wow.
It was the day after everyone had gone home. And so we were just sat around having beers and chatting away.
That's fantastic. Oh, I've got a kind of glamorous story. I did meet Christopher Eccleston in 1997. I was a film extra, so I was like very briefly. I was his lighting stand-in because we had similar jackets on a. I think it was a Michael Winterbottom film he was in with Dervla Kerwin. It was on location in a pub. So I got lit. Then he came in from makeup and gave me a little hug. Said thanks, mate. And then I fucked off. And that was my Christopher Eccleston story. Yeah.
And that was before he was the Doctor, or was that?
That was 8 years before he was the Doctor. Yeah, he just come off Cracker.
His death in Cracker is amazing. Spoiler anyone who hasn't seen Cracker, but I met Jodie Whittaker when I was a film journalist. I met her at the party for Venus, which was like her screen debut.
Oh, brilliant!
She was 18, 19 or something ridiculous, and that literally was the last person you thought I'm meeting a future Doctor Who now. 19-year-old woman from Huddersfield, but wonderful. I wonder how long before Big Finish will lure her in. We'll see.
Yeah, well, yes,
Poker face. But anyway, so we don't run over.
Sure.
Final choice, which I was going to sort of put near the beginning because I thought it was one of your sort of probably from early in your life, but we ended up going where we went, which is sort of Terence Dix and the Dalek Invasion of Earth novelization.
Yes, stalked the ruin of a man. It's
where did that come in your life?
Early, about definitely. I had a load of time. Then again, you know, back then you could walk into a charity shop or a school jumble sale, and you'd have all these, Armada ghost story collections and Doctor Who Target novels, all on sale for like 5 or 10p or whatever, and you could just claw them in. You know, you could go home with armfuls. You know,
these are our Madeleine cakes, aren't they? That is just literally, sparking images in my head of. All those books.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I'd get them from, it was, school jumble sales and, all that kind of thing. And so, I mean, The Dalek Invasion of Earth, I think I just kind of picked because of that opening line. But also just that, as a 7-8-year-old, that kind of post-apocalyptic dread that it's got, that kind of, that tough, Terry Nation survival horror feeling that... It's a much more grueling read than it is to watch as a bit of 1960s television. It's it's tough, and a lot reading. All the Target novels I had, which I went and I gave them all away because I'm a twat. Yeah. It's just gritty, violent, dangerous, and yet you've got this hero, the Doctor, who is however bad things get, he's untouchable, and you're safe because you're with him.
Yeah.
That's the draw.
Like many of us, did Terence spur you on to doing your first writing and writing science fiction? I certainly did. I started writing things that were very much like my own version of what were they called? The American Space Service. I wrote. American Space Personnel, ASP, like the snake. And
yes, yeah,
Alex. And that was basically me writing Doctor Who books as a kid.
I think you're absolutely right. It's that he had such an engaging and clear prose style, Terence Dix, that fantastic to read, but also kind of easy to emulate. And I think Over the years, I think I've probably underestimated how much reading the Target books is actually, you know, just very, very good in terms of my early literacy, but also in terms of an ability and kind of a facility for writing prose fiction. And it's probably kind of, you know, really my, it was and would have been my greatest, in terms of Doctor Who input, my greatest source of kind of soaking all that stuff up. Most of my knowledge of Doctor Who came from the reading the Target novels.
Yeah, we have that in common with us 70s childs, because we didn't get to see it on telly except when it was on telly. And
exactly, yeah, yeah.
It was rows and rows of hardbacks in the library that were, which is why I don't really have very many of them, because we didn't buy them, but we had every single one in hardback in a big section in the library. And they
just, yeah, I had.
It's got six every week, and the same.
Yeah, one that reminds me, because I did have like ex library copies, because they had like the partially pulled out library sticker in the front, all that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I could still sort of smell them and just.
It's the smell that gets you.
Yeah, God, it's just it's wonderful. And here we are, you especially, but me a little bit. And hopefully more with the forthcoming Big Finish I've written. I'm actually getting paid to write this shit. So it's brilliant.
I know.
It's brilliant. I've written many things for money, but getting to write the stuff I've written, review script editing, it was real, like, I kept phoning people up going, guess what I'm writing?
it's a drug. It's definitely a drug.
But it's just weird to be, you know, looking back at tell your 8-year-old self what you're doing today for money.
Exactly. I know. Yeah. Yeah. It's a constant source of delight. And I think a lot of it is just kind of being able to kind of reconnect with your, you know, your younger self, you know, that and that young brain in a way as well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's brilliant. My midlife crisis hasn't been buying cars. It's been podcasting about Doctor Who after all these years and writing Doctor Who related things for comics and now at last for Big Finish. So so I can thank you for that.
Thank you I think my midlife crisis might start involving buying back all the Target novels I gave away.
Yeah, that might be cheaper at this stage in the fandom to buy a flash car.
This is true.
They're like, oh, have you seen Original Sin? Is like £50, and I gave mine to a bloody charity shop.
I'll get the Maserati then. You know, I'm not even into cars, but hey,
be cheaper than an addiction to Target books probably. But anyway, it's been an absolute pleasure to meet you for the first time after our many email exchanges.
It's odd, isn't it? We've done it the wrong way around. But yes, it's good. Thank you so much. This has been so much fun. This is the best nuclear apocalypse I've ever been in. It really
is. I know. It's I don't know what I was going to say then. I'll probably have to edit that. I just sort of drifted off. But yes. I was musing about other nuclear apocalypses I might have been in, but I haven't, have I? So I've had a day on this damn computer, so it's rocked my brain. But I'll just quickly say, so I can edit to this bit, just quickly say, Robert Valentine, it's been an absolute pleasure. And I will see you for more notes on more scripts in the future.
Absolutely, Ian Winterton. It's been a really, really great chat.
And hopefully see you in the real world.
Definitely, definitely. First pint's on me. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Definitely. Then where do you live?
Darkest Surrey.
You have been listening to The Bonker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by Jane Steventon of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at cutawayu.